nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Okay, let's continue our discussion on timing analysis and optimization. In the last two lectures, we've talked about timing analysis, which is the problem of, given a circuit, how do you find out how fast you can clock it? We discussed two major approaches to that problem. The first was topological timing analysis, which just looked at the structure of the circuit and the delays of the different gates, and said that timing analysis basically is a problem of analyzing the paths in the circuit, longest and shortest paths. And we also talked about some more advanced concepts that will not only tell you how fast you can clock a circuit or whether a certain timing constraint is met, but also give you some diagnostic feedback as to if you'd like your circuit to be faster, which parts of the circuit are actually in the critical paths, which parts are responsible for determining the circuit's delay, and where you should focus your design effort if you'd like to make your circuit go faster. So that is topological timing analysis. Then we also discussed the false path problem, which is essentially observation that not all paths in circuits are capable of propagating transitions, because some of them are functionally, have certain constraints that'll cause them to never be able to determine the circuit's delay. So then we talked about functional timing analysis or false path aware timing analysis, where the problem is to find out the clock period of the circuit while ignoring all the false paths. So for that, we saw a couple of different definitions of what it means for a path to be true or false, and eventually nailed down the definition under the floating mode of delay as to what exactly a false path is or a true path is. And then we formulated the problem of finding the longest true path in a circuit as a SAT problem. Rather than going path by path, we essentially said that we would formulate these functions, timed functions, which would evaluate the value at the output of the circuit at a certain time and try to see if those functions differ from the functions eventually computed by the circuit. In other words, if the circuit had infinite time, what would the function evaluate to? And by looking at whether those functions differ, we could see whether for all possible inputs, the circuit output would ever change greater than a certain time. So by formulating it in a different way, we avoided the problem of enumerating all the paths, and we were able to formulate it as a SAT problem. Okay, so that concluded with the last lecture that brought us to the end of timing analysis. Today's lecture is going to be focused on timing optimization. So given a circuit, how can I make it go faster? There is different stages in logic synthesis in which timing and optimization can be performed. The first, which is what we're going to be focusing on in this lecture, is circuit restructuring. And this can be performed either during technology independent optimization or during technology mapping. But the key idea is to get a good global structure for the circuit. Okay? A common example of this would be that if you have a circuit that is in the form of a chain, imbalanced chain, turning it into a balanced, more balanced structure like a balanced tree is likely going to help the circuit's delay. And that observation probably is going to be true independent of the specific constants involved, the delays of the individual gates, right? So you can do it during technology independent optimization as well. So circuit restructuring is one of the ways in which you can optimize the delay of a circuit during logic synthesis, get a good overall structure for the circuit. And then when doing technology mapping, of course, you can select cells from your cell library such that the delay is optimized. We've already seen how this works in the context of tree-based technology mapping, right? So decompose your circuit into trees, and each tree can be mapped for minimum delay. We talked about the algorithm to do that using dynamic programming. What we did not talk about is a couple of things. First is, the major issue there is if you're given a circuit, which is a DAG, once you break it down into trees, you are trying to optimize delay across the overall circuit, not for individual trees. So you do have to go through the process of delay budgeting, where you take the clock period constraint for your entire circuit and apportion it, budget it for the individual trees. Okay. Now, if you do that suboptimally, you can have two problems. One is that if you're too aggressive, your technology mapping for the trees may come back and say that there is no feasible solution, so may not be able to find a feasible solution. Or you may use excessive cost in terms of area or power for the hardware for those individual trees, right? So the same problem arises even when you have hierarchical designs. In practice, we haven't really been talking about hierarchical designs. We assume that the entire network is one flat network of gates. But in practice, when you scale to large millions and millions of gates, you need circuits to be expressed hierarchically. And it is not computationally feasible to flatten the whole circuit and deal with it as one single flat netlist or flat circuit. So you need the same delay budgeting problem also arises when you have a hierarchy where you need to apportion. Sometimes if you have combinational paths stretching across different modules in the hierarchy, the same delay budgeting problem there as well. Okay. Then also important is the fan-out optimization problem. So this arises because of the fact that if you look at the structure of a circuit, a general DAG, we said that we're going to break it down into these trees, and in between those trees, you have these fan-out points, which can essentially be wires that go to multiple places, or multiple signals, or multiple trees. Now, fan-out optimization focuses on optimizing the interconnects or the delays of these fan-out wires, right? So this is typically something that is performed once you have a good idea or good feel for the interconnect capacitance, the interconnect parasitics, right? So you know the interconnect delays. If the interconnect delays are large, eventually they are also going to affect your clock period. So buffer insertion or adding these buffer trees in between the fan-out trees basically addresses the problem of how do you also manage the delays of these interconnects, these fan-outs that go across the trees, right? And last but not the least is the problem of circuit sizing. So you can think of this as a more constrained version of the technology mapping problem. In technology mapping, you are choosing different cells with different functionality and trying to map the circuit onto the cells in your cell library. In addition, each cell function in the library typically comes at different sizes or different drive strengths. Right? So you're trying to solve both the problems at once. In circuit sizing, it's a more constrained version of the problem where all that you're doing is determining the, you do not want to change the cells. All that you would like to do is change the drive strengths of the cells or the sizes of the transistors in the cells. Why would you want to do that? Well, you know, of course, technology mapping is, you're solving more things at once. But sometimes, for example, technology mapping may be done before physical design. So you may not have a good idea of the actual individual wire lengths and the locations of the different cells. Now, after you go through the place and route process, you may have a better idea of the interconnects. At that point, the technology mapping that you initially did may no longer be valid or optimal, right? Now, you could say that now that I know my interconnect parasitics, why not go back and do a technology mapping again? You could do that, but one, if you substantially change the circuit, you'll have to go back and redo the place and route, and those wiring capacitances or parasitics may change again. And this loop may or may not converge, right? So, in practice, circuit sizing is often used in that context to make incremental changes, also known as, you know, ECO, incremental change optimizations, where what you do is you say that my cells are going to be the same. All that I'll do is I'll change the sizes or the drive strengths of the cells. Typically, when you're, especially in the context of a standard cell-based layout, the changes that are incurred through circuit resizing on the layout are minimal. So you will not really need to redo a full-blown new place and route. Okay. You might just have minor adjustments that you need to make in the layout, and essentially the interconnect parasitics that you are assuming in doing the circuit sizing will not be greatly disturbed. So circuit sizing is a more constrained version of the technology mapping problem. In addition, another remark I'd like to make here is we already saw that technology mapping for pre-structured circuits is polynomial time. It's very efficient, but it's very complex for a full DAG. What is interesting is when you limit yourself to just circuit sizing, the problem becomes very efficient for arbitrary DAGs. So in other words, not just trees, you can take the full circuit as a DAG as is and perform circuit sizing on the entire circuit. Okay. So that's another reason to, you know, look at this more constrained problem, because you can solve it efficiently and optimally for arbitrary combinational circuits, not just without breaking them down into trees. Okay. So hopefully I've given you a flavor of the different places in logic synthesis where timing can be optimized. We will be focusing on circuit restructuring. Well, we've already talked about technology mapping for delay, and circuit sizing is like a subset of that, so we're not going to be talking about it here. And this is really an interconnect optimization problem. So, you know, we're not really dealing with physical design in this course, so we're not going to be talking about buffer tree implementation either. So circuit restructuring is primarily what we're going to be dealing with for this lecture. So circuit restructuring, once again, is about finding a right overall structure for the circuit so that it is efficient in terms of delay or fast. Now, it turns out that well before these techniques for delay optimization were invented, designers were manually designing fast circuits for a long, long time already. In particular, arithmetic circuits, simple structures like adders, multipliers, and so on, had been optimized by designers for a long time. So it's not surprising that the people who came up with automatic synthesis techniques that optimize the circuit delay drew some inspiration from the manual design techniques that people had used to make circuits fast. In particular, we will be talking about a few different circuit restructuring approaches, general approaches, but I'll be trying to present them as generalizations of fast architectures for adders. Okay. And the first technique we'll talk about is motivated from carry look-ahead adders. And the technique is called collapsing and restructuring, also known as height reduction. And we'll see how the concept that is used to design a carry look-ahead adder was generalized and applied to arbitrary circuits. I mean, note that this is not a trivial generalization, right? Something works for an adder to something works for an arbitrary Boolean circuit. Nevertheless, they were inspired by fast arithmetic circuit architectures. Next, we'll be talking about carry select adders and how we can generalize this approach that is used to design fast carry select adders into what is known as a generalized select transform. And then we'll also finally talk about carry bypass adder, which is a different type of fast adder architecture, and see how that inspired the generalized bypass transform. Hopefully you all remember from your undergraduate digital design classes how a carry look-ahead adder is designed, right? This is a ripple carry adder, right? It's slow because you have this linear length chain computing the carry out. So you have your two sets of input bits, you have the two sum bits, and the carry, essentially you compute the carry of the first bit here, and that is used to compute the carry of the second bit, right, in a ripple manner. Now, in carry look-ahead adders, what you do, essentially what you do, is that you take this long path, which is generating the carry, and you say that rather than compute this inefficiently using several levels of logic, I'm going to directly express the carry bits of all the bit slices in the adder, right, in terms of the so-called propagate and generate bits. The propagate and generate bits themselves are only functions of the primary inputs. So in other words, rather than having this cascaded type structure to compute the carry, I'm going to say that the propagate bits are defined as follows, right? The P0 is A0 XOR B0, which is anyway, this XOR gate is anyway needed to compute the sum. So that gate can be shared between the sum logic and the carry logic. And G0 is A0 and B0. Conceptually, the propagate and generate bits are appropriately named. Propagate bit tells you when an input carry at that slice is going to propagate to the output, and the generate bit tells you when a carry is going to be generated at that bit slice, right? So given these propagate and generate bits, you express the carries directly in terms of these propagate and generate bits, right? And of course the carry in to the entire adder. So what you say is, the first equation is telling you is that you can have a carry at the output of the first bit slice either by propagating a carry from the input, the carry in, or by generating a carry in that bit slice itself. Similarly, for the next bit slice, you can either have the carry in propagate through two bit slices, have a carry generated at bit slice, the first bit slice, propagate it through the second bit slice, or generate the carry in the second bit slice. So this is just enumerating the different ways in which you can have a carry here. Note that all of these are expressed in terms of two-level expressions here, in these expressions. So in a sense, what you've done is you have taken the logic that generates the carry and expressed it, taken the logic and collapsed it, and directly expressed that logic, the logic, that function that generates for the carry, for the different carry bits, in terms of these generate bits, which are themselves only purely in terms of the primary inputs. So what are you really doing in this process of taking a ripple carry adder and transforming it into a carry look-ahead adder? You're taking the critical path, because in general, the carry propagation is going to be causing the critical path. So you're taking this critical path, or in this case, you know, here, this is the critical path, and restructuring the critical path by collapsing this logic function into two-level expressions, as shown in the previous slide, and possibly re-implementing it. Eventually, we know that we don't want to just take the critical path in a circuit and make it two-level, right? We know two-level implementations are not efficient for many functions, right? And we'll talk about that. We'll talk about scalability. But for now, conceptually, you can think of taking this path, collapsing it, and then rewriting it in this manner, right? So this is nothing but, so if you look at this carefully, you'll see that this is nothing but the expression for C2 that I had on the previous slide, right? Either you generate a carry in the second bit slice, or you generate it in the first bit slice and propagate it through the second bit slice, or you take the carry in and propagate it through the first two bit slices. There are three ways in which you can generate the carry. Now, by expressing this carry circuit as a more balanced tree rather than this linear unbalanced chain, you are making the adder faster, right? So that's basically the concept. You're collapsing the critical path and restructuring it. The same concept can be generalized to arbitrary Boolean networks. We did it manually for a carry look-ahead adder, but given an arbitrary Boolean circuit, you can do the same thing. But you need to define a few concepts. Okay, so let's see, for example, if you're given a Boolean network that has this structure with inputs A through G, and the nodes internally are just labeled, this could be, during technology-independent optimization, each of these nodes could have some complex sum of products expression inside it. Right? So this could be a technology-independent Boolean network. The first thing we need to do is determine which parts of the circuit you need to restructure. And that timing analysis already tells us, right? So in this case, assume that the arrival times of the inputs are shown here. For whatever reason, we assume that E is arriving a little late in this example. And we can propagate these arrival times, the latest arrival times, to the output. So we'll see that the delay of the circuit is 6, right? And then we can also identify the critical paths or epsilon critical network for the circuit. So we can identify, if we identify that these are the set of nodes that are responsible for the delay of the circuit being 6, this is the critical region of the circuit, then what we need to do is now to somehow restructure this region such that the overall delay of the circuit is improved. Think back to what you did with carry look-ahead adders. Conceptually, what we said was we are going to collapse this region, right? And when you're collapsing the region, note that in general, in a multi-level circuit, you may have fan out at some of the nodes. So some of this logic may be shared, not just with the output that is on the critical path, but with other outputs as well. Okay? And it may be desirable not to touch the delays of the other outputs. So one way of achieving that is by duplicating the logic. Of course, that has a certain cost with it. It has a hardware cost. But we are trying to optimize the timing here. So in general, we are potentially willing to accept hardware cost. We'll see later on how to quantify this and how to do this in a more quantitative manner. But for now, what we are doing here is we have taken this critical region, is calling it N prime. We've created a new copy of that we just call N prime. So all of these nodes have been collapsed. Think of collapsing all of their functions into one giant two-level expression that is given in this collapsed critical region node here. These nodes have been replicated because you want to maintain the timing on the other output, which is and not disturb the timing there. So you have to replicate some of the nodes. Now, if you look at this collapsed critical region, if you look at its inputs, the timing profile of its inputs, you see that one of its inputs arrives at time 1, the other two at time 0, and this last input at time 2. Now, what can you do differently to optimize the timing in the collapsed critical region? Any thoughts or suggestions? You want to take the late arriving inputs and impose minimum additional delay on them when going to the outputs, right? Of course, the other output doesn't change, but what you could do is you could take this critical region and the input arrival profile gives you the context of this critical region, and you can optimize the timing profile of this circuit, of this region, this logic, to match the timing profile of the inputs, right? How can you do that? For example, this might be one way in which you want to take this collapsed critical region and derive a different multi-level structure, which is different from the original structure.
And in this case, what we've done is we've taken the late arriving input, which is E, which arrives at time 2, and we fed it directly at the output node. So this is a different structure for the logic inside the collapse critical region that better suits the timing profile of its inputs. Okay? So that's what this logic duplication and collapsing allows you to do. If you did not duplicate the logic, you would have to consider the timing constraints or timing profiles of a potentially, you know, multiple outputs. Here, this allows you to completely customize the structure to this particular context, the set of inputs and that one output that it is generating. Okay. So the key idea to summarize is to collapse, identify a critical region, collapse the region, potentially replicating logic in the process when you do that collapsing, and then restructure that region, rederive a more optimal multi-level structure based on the input and output timing constraints or timing profile. And by doing this, you see that if you propagate timing information, you've made this, the arrival time of n prime is now 4. Recall previously it was 6. Of course, you need to look at all the paths in the circuit, so the delay of the circuit now becomes 5, which is determined by a different critical path. And you can repeat this process. Now you can again identify another critical region, collapse it, and try to restructure it to optimize its timing, and so on and so forth. So how do we do this in a more general manner? So we need to come up with a generic methodology for doing this kind of collapsing and restructuring. Here is a high-level sketch of how it works. While the timing of your circuit improves, you select the logic region to transform. That is just out of timing analysis. Use critical paths, epsilon critical network, which gives you the logic region to transform. Collapse the selected region. One potential issue that might arise here is that you may not be able to collapse the entire region because it may blow up. The size of the two-level expression may blow up. So you may want to only collapse a limited number of levels of logic. You may not collapse it entirely. But that's certainly something you can do. So collapse the selected region, and then now you resynthesize this to improve the timing. Okay. The details of this procedure are described in the two papers shown here, which I will be uploading on Blackboard. But we will be describing some of the key questions involved that were addressed in these papers. We'll be looking at some of these, the key questions, namely, which are the regions? How do you identify the right regions to restructure? And how do you resynthesize those regions? We'll be trying to address those questions in a little greater detail. Okay. So first question is, how do you identify which regions to restructure? As I already said, you start off with the epsilon critical network. As we already know, when you look at all the nodes which are within a slack of epsilon, of the minimum slack of all nodes in the circuit, they form this well-connected network of paths from primary inputs to primary outputs. That's what we call the epsilon critical network, and I've shown that here for an example circuit. The key idea here is, what will you need to do to speed up the epsilon critical network? You know that these are the nodes that are causing the circuit to have the delay that it has. So what can you do to speed up the circuit's delay? One possibility is you collapse this entire thing into one two-level expression and then, you know, regenerate a more optimal multi-level structure for it. Sure, you could do that. But if the number of levels of logic in your circuit is large, then A, you'll be replicating a lot of logic because of these fan-outs, and B, your two-level expression may be very large. So you may not want to collapse everything. More importantly, when you're collapsing it, you would like to minimize the hardware cost. You would like to do this in an efficient way, right? Just because you want a fast circuit doesn't mean you're willing to waste area or waste power. You'd like to do this in an efficient way. So rather than collapse the entire set of epsilon critical, the entire epsilon critical network, what you can recognize is that if you take a cut set of this network, right, a cut set or a separator set of a graph is a set of vertices which, if you remove from the graph, will split it up into two. It'll make it into two disjoint subgraphs. It cuts it into two, hence the name cut set, right? So if you take any set of nodes that cuts the graph into two, and you speed up those nodes, or the arrival times at the outputs of those nodes, you know that eventually the output will be faster, Because any path has to go through those nodes. So as long as those, you improve the arrival times and the outputs of those nodes in the cut set, the final primary outputs will, their arrival times will improve. So one possible cut set for this epsilon critical network is a single node shown there. But there's several possible cut sets for a given graph, right? It's not unique. So another example would be this. So you need some way of figuring out which cut set to actually use, which is the most beneficial, most promising cut set for timing optimization. And there's two factors, right? So you need to define some notion of a cost such that you can identify the minimum cost cut set of the epsilon critical network. And you collapse those nodes in the cut set or those nodes with some number of levels of logic feeding them. Okay. But how do you identify those nodes? Well, the cost of this cut set is computed based on two factors. The first is the potential for delay improvement. So trying to optimize a node, collapse a node and restructure it is not going to be of much help if the node is already optimal from a timing perspective. If the original structure you have is already optimal, you're just going to be running around in circles doing useless work. Right? So you'd like to identify regions or parts of this epsilon critical network that have a suboptimal structure from a timing point of view. That is consideration number one. What is the potential for delay improvement if you collapse and restructure? And the second is, of course, the hardware cost, which is the estimate of how much logic will be duplicated. Now, the second one is relatively easier. We already have a metric, literal count. You can look at the literals in these nodes, or if you're going to be collapsing a certain number of levels, k levels of logic feeding those nodes, you can look at these nodes and the k levels of gates before or nodes before them, sum up the literal counts. That gives you a measure of how much logic is going to be duplicated. You could be a little more accurate and only look at those nodes with fan out and say that only those are going to be duplicated, others are not. But basically, it's using literal count to estimate logic. The first criterion is a little more tricky, so we'll look at that in a little more detail. How do you estimate for a given cut set what is the potential for delay improvement if I collapse this cut set or some region comprising of this cut set, these nodes and the nodes feeding them? Once you do that, we'll address that in the next slide, but once you do that, suppose somehow you are able to define a cost function such that you could compute, associate a cost with each of the nodes. There are very well-known algorithms for identifying the minimum cost cut set in a graph, assuming that you have a reasonably well-structured, well-behaved cost function for the nodes. And it turns out that the min-cut algorithm is actually the dual of the well-known max flow or network flow problem, which is, you know, very, very widely used in optimization, operations research and so on, right? So this is a very efficient algorithm that can be used to identify the minimum cut set once you have the costs defined. We won't be going into the details of the algorithm, but let's talk about this criterion. How do you estimate the potential for delay improvement for a given set of nodes? So given a node in this epsilon critical network, how do you tell if there is some potential for delay optimization? I'm going to give you an example or use this conceptual example to highlight it. So here is the epsilon critical region, and this is a epsilon critical network. This is a relatively small network. So let's say that we are going to be looking at four levels of logic. So, you know, let's say this is the node N and the four levels of logic feeding it, all of which are going to be collapsed into one two-level expression. How do you tell, looking at just this region in the original network, what is the potential for improvement? One way is, of course, you can collapse it and try to restructure it and see if you get any benefit. That's a very costly way. It's a very slow way of doing it. How can you quickly tell whether there is potential for improvement? The inputs of this region are shown here, right? There are six inputs to this region. So what you can do is you can look at the delay profile of the candidate region that you're going to collapse. Don't really collapse it. Just look at the arrival times of its inputs and the structure of this region vis-a-vis those arrival times. So this is a region to be collapsed. The delay profile of this region is nothing but a plot of the arrival time at the input versus the delay, the additional delay that that input needs to face, the longest path from that input to the output of this critical region, right? So you have, in this case, six inputs, H through M. Each of them has a certain arrival time. And if you look at this region, each of those inputs has to propagate through some additional delay to reach the output. So in other words, arrival time of H is the time at which the input arrives, H arrives. D of H comma N is the longest path through this region from H to the output of the region. Now, if you plot these two variables, right, for each input, you have a certain arrival time and you have a certain delay through the logic. So if you plot the delay versus arrival time, in this case, you know, for example, we have 6 inputs. So each of the inputs corresponds to a point. Suppose you had a profile, delay profile like that looked like this versus a delay profile that looked like this. Right? Let me ask you the question, which of these two profiles actually means that there is some scope for optimization? Which of these two profiles tells you, if I give you a region that is characterized by delay profile 1 and another region that's characterized by delay profile 2 and told you you can pick one of these two to optimize the overall delay of the circuit, which of these two would you pick? You'll pick the one which is suboptimal, right? So that you have opportunity for improvement. Which of these two delay profiles is not good? The second delay profile. Why?
Because inputs are arriving late. No, okay. The delay is less.
But you're on the right track. So remember the intuition, right? Late arriving inputs, would you want them to see a lot of delay or very little delay?
Very little.
You would like them to see very little delay. So if you look at this, the first profile, what's happening? Late arriving inputs. So this is the x-axis is the arrival times at the inputs of the region. The y-axis is the further delay that those inputs are seeing to propagate to the output. And each point corresponds to a different input. So late arriving inputs are actually having to propagate through larger delays. Or you're imposing more delays on late arriving inputs. And that's the wrong thing to do. So this profile is precisely the type of profile that you should pick for optimization. So a region which has this profile has a potential to improve the circuit, to improve the timing if it is restructured. Whereas a region that already has this profile, you know, this is already optimal or close, likely to be less, more closer to optimal from a timing point of view. The opportunity for improvement is going to be lower. So essentially, by looking at the slope of this graph, you can quantify the opportunity for improvement in timing. So that's exactly what you do. So only by looking at the arrival times of the inputs and the paths through this critical region, these are purely derived from timing analysis. You're not doing any resynthesis for this purpose. Just by taking information from timing analysis, you can look at a candidate region and draw this delay profile and tell whether it's a good candidate for optimization or not. Right? So that is as far as how do you identify the region to restructure. Animation, I guess, was a little out of sync. What do you do to actually restructure this region? So, suppose you identified the region to restructure. First thing you do is collapse the nodes in that cut set along with the transitive fan-in nodes up to some logic depth. And that logic depth that you choose to collapse is really a parameter that you as a designer will have to choose. It's a trade-off between how much time the synthesis tool is going to spend versus the quality of results. Okay. Now, once you've done this collapsing, you want to be resynthesizing the collapsed region. And there's two different ways of doing this resynthesis, right, that we will talk about. One of them is factoring. So remember, once you have a two-level representation of the collapsed region, you want to turn it back into a multi-level circuit, but hopefully a more optimal one from a timing point of view. These are two of the things that we do, right, to turn two-level circuits into multi-level circuits. First is factoring, where you look at common factors across multiple nodes and try to extract them out, thereby creating multi-level circuits. Or you try to decompose a large node into two smaller nodes, right? Now, in doing timing-driven factoring and timing-driven decomposition, the key idea that you need to keep in mind is that the later arriving inputs should be used closer to the outputs. Therefore, they should experience lower delay through the region, right? In other words, you want to take a timing profile that looked like the suboptimal profile and turn it into a timing profile that looked like the more optimal one. So here's an example of timing-driven factoring, very simple example. Okay. Suppose this is your node, ABC plus ABF, 4 inputs. You'd like to extract the best factor from a timing point of view. You'd like to factor this node or decompose it in a timing optimal way, and there's two different scenarios. If A is late arriving, what would you do? And if B is late arriving, what would you do? If A is late arriving, you would like, as you create a multi-level structure for this, you would like A to feed as close to the output as possible. You don't want A to go through too many additional levels of logic because it's already late arriving. So what you'll do is you'll first try to factor A out so that A can feed close to the output, and then further you can decompose or factor out this remaining expression. On the other hand, if B is late arriving, you will prioritize B when choosing factors. Okay. So now go back to all the concepts we talked about in multi-level synthesis, right? Kernels, co-kernels, all of that still applies, extracting factors. You just have a way, rather than using literals to guide which is the best factor to pick, you have another way of guiding which is the best factor to pick. The literals which have higher delay will be the ones you want to pick out as factors initially, as early as possible, so that they feed close to the primary outputs, or at least outputs of this region. So, all of the concepts we talked about in multi-level synthesis still hold, except you have a different metric or a different cost function to guide the selection of the best factor. You use the arrival times of all these variables, input variables to that node or this region, collapse region. Those arrival times will be used to prioritize the factors as opposed to just literal count or value. You use the timing. Okay? But everything else stays pretty much the same. Any questions thus far? Okay. So it turns out that in the special case decomposition, the special case of AND trees or OR trees, if you have, you know, a huge AND gate, AND function of large number of inputs, or just an OR function of large number of inputs, it turns out that there is an efficient greedy algorithm to do this, which actually turns out to be optimal. So it's worth mentioning. What you do is suppose the problem is you're given an n input AND or n input OR. I guess you could do this for an n input XOR as well, because, you know, all of those are, can be decomposed. So given an n input function, if you'd like to decompose it into these two input gates, a network of multi-level network of two input gates in a timing driven manner, such that the timing of this region is optimized, you can do it as follows. This while loop essentially recursively extracts one factor or decomposes it, and you keep going until you have more than two inputs left, because eventually you want to have only two input gates. You select the two earliest arriving inputs and create a gate with those and substitute this gate G's output into the original function F, and so on. So here, rather than going from the output to the inputs, you're going from the inputs to the output. So you take the earliest arriving inputs and feed them to the first level of logic, because those are the ones that can tolerate the maximum delay. And you keep doing this. Okay. So here's an example. Suppose this is a 4-input AND gate. This is the timing profile of the inputs. A arrives at time 0, B is time 0, C is 1, D is 2. You pick the first earliest arriving inputs, which is you'll construct an AND gate with A and B first. And then, say we call its output X, so this becomes X, C, D. This is going to be the first step. And then in the next step, what you do is you pick the next two, so the arrival times now will be C is going to be 1, D is going to be 2 as before. So if you assume a unit delay model, this arrival time is going to be 1. So in the next stage, you pick these two inputs to cluster together. So the next network that you form is going to be completeness. Okay. So in this case, actually, a balanced tree is actually bad because the arrival times at the inputs are not all uniform. So you actually want an imbalanced chain where the later arriving input is actually feeding closer to the output, right? So this algorithm will work in general to decompose any node into two input gates, with an optimal timing profile. Okay. It's just linear time, yet very efficient and yet optimal. Okay, so that essentially summarizes the first technique, which is known as collapsing and restructuring, also known as height reduction, because what you're doing is, in a sense, you're taking a structure which may have multiple levels of logic, which has a long path or a very tall path, if you look at it vertically, and reducing its height to improve the delay. Let's look at the second technique known as carry which is inspired by carry bypass adders. And the general technique is known as the generalized bypass transform. So the carry bypass adder was something that we had already talked about in class when we talked about false paths. We gave this as an example of false path. Starting off with a ripple carry adder, how do you turn it into a fast bypass adder? Well, you recognize that the carry propagation from the carry into the carry out occurs exactly when A0 XOR B0 equals 1 and A1 XOR B1 equals 1. So you, in those conditions, when the carry in directly propagates to the carry out, rather than propagating it through several levels of logic, you add this bypass path where the carry in is directly routed to the carry out, and you add the appropriate condition that selects the input of the multiplexer, that selects the bypass path when A0 XOR B0 is 1, when the two propagate bits are 1, essentially. Okay. So what you've done essentially is taken a path of length 5 and turned it into a false path. In the original circuit, it was not a false path, but in this modified circuit, it's become a false path, and you've replaced it with another path of length 1. Right? So this is the carry bypass adder. How can you generalize this? Right? So the general principle is identify the longest path and make the longest path false by adding these bypass paths. Right? So that concept is known as the generalized bypass transform and was published in 1991 in the paper shown here. In general, if you have a circuit and a path in the circuit with a sequence of nodes, so this is a sequence of nodes in the circuit starting with F, which is Fm, Fm plus 1, and so on to G, which is the last node in the path. Suppose you would like to make this, suppose this is your critical path, the path shown in red, and you would like to make it false to improve the delay of the circuit. What you're going to do is add this multiplexer, right, where ideally you'd like to take the output of F, bypass all these nodes, Fm plus 1 through Fn, and directly take the output of F and feed it to where G used to go, right? The key to doing this is, of course, your functionality of the circuit should still remain correct. So the key to doing this is to design the appropriate function to drive the select signal of this multiplexer. Therein, you know, lies the entire complexity of doing this, right? So you can take, given a general path in a circuit, if you would like to bypass some segment of the path, right, this can be a segment of your critical path, for instance, you'd like to bypass it by taking one of the gate outputs and bypassing some gates in the path and feeding it at a later location, what is the condition that would have to be true? You would like to, when the select signal is 1, you would like the select signal to be 1 when the output essentially is sensitive to the value at F. If the output is insensitive to the value at F, then you don't want this path to propagate. You would like to go, you know, maybe some other inputs will determine the output, right? So what you would like to do is, of course, in this case, we are assuming, I'll further state an assumption, which is that this path is non-inverting. Okay, so let's suppose that all these functions, you know, are non-inverting, right? So that's the reason you've taken F and propagated it out to replace G with F rather than F prime. If not, you could have put an inverter. If this path is inverting, then you could put an inverter here. So let's assume it's non-inverting. So you are directly using F to bypass the path. When can you do that? You can do that when G is sensitive to F. And we have a function that we already defined that tells you exactly when, you know, any variable in the circuit is sensitive to something else or one of the inputs. That is nothing but the Boolean difference. So if you take dou G by dou F, the Boolean difference of G with respect to F, and with the additional assumption that this path is non-inverting, if you take the Boolean difference, what that tells you is the condition under which you can take F and directly bypass this path and substitute G by F. Now, if the path were inverting, you would just put an inverter. You would say G equals F prime when dou G by dou F is true. Okay. An interesting side note is, so you could do this generally for given any sequence of nodes in a path, in a larger circuit, if this is a critical path, you can bypass a segment of the path and set dou G by dou F to this control condition. Now, you've potentially incurred some additional area overhead because you need to actually generate this function dou G by dou F. Okay? But potentially, if this path was the critical path, you've reduced its delay by making it false.
Okay.
Note that in the circuit, a stuck at zero here is actually redundant. What will a stuck at zero fault here do? It'll just turn the circuit into the original circuit, right? So this circuit actually has a redundancy. However, because of the fact that the longest path is being made false, the circuit is actually faster than the original circuit. So that is the generalized bypass transform. Let's look at another example of speed-up technique, a circuit transformation that was again inspired by yet another class of fast adders. And in this case, it's known as the generalized select transform. It was inspired by carry select adders. So are we all familiar, anybody familiar with how a carry select adder works? Well, you know that the carry path, the path that propagates the carry in to the carry out, is the critical path in general in adders, in ripple carry adders at least. So what you do is you take the carry in and you speculate on both possibilities of its value. So carry in can either be 0 or carry in can be 1. So what you do is, if you compute the output, the sum and the carry out of the adder, assuming the carry is in is 0, and yet another time, assuming the carry in is 1, you know that one of these two cases has to hold, has to be the correct output. So what you do is you essentially have two copies of your adder, or two different adders. Now these adders could be anything. This could be a, you know, ripple carry adder, or these adders could be a tree structured adder, carry look ahead, whatever else. 4-bit adder, hardwire the carry into 0. Another copy of the 4-bit adder, hardwire the carry to 1. And depending on the carry in, you select the appropriate outputs of the appropriate adder. If the carry in indeed is a 0, you know that the top adder's outputs will be the correct sum and carry. If the carry in reality is a 1, you know that the bottom adder's outputs will be the correct sum and carry. Of course, you've replicated the adder here, but what you have done is that you have drastically reduced the length of the path from the carry in to the carry out. Okay. And the benefit of that may not be apparent just by looking at this 4-bit structure, but in reality, when you're trying to cascade these structures to build larger bit-width adders, think about what happens. The carry in sees only one multiplexer delay before being propagated to the next stage. So if you cascade n of these stages, you just have n multiplexers. That's it. Right? So that is why, you know, so the delay seen by the carry in eventually propagating through the carry out is drastically reduced. Right? Does it make sense? If just viewed alone, you may not get that much of a benefit. But when you cascade these 4-bit segments, what happens is that normally you would have to propagate from the carry in through the carry path through your adder structure and then feed that into the carry in here and propagate again. So those carry paths will get cascaded. Instead, what you've done here is you've just taken a multiplexer delay here and just another multiplexer delay here. All of these speculate on the carry, respective carries, and compute in parallel. They are not dependent on each other anymore. So this is one of the ways in which you can design a fast adder, the carry select adder. Question is, how do you generalize this, right? The concept here is you compute the function for both possible values of one of the inputs, and based on that input, what value it actually takes, eventually decide which copy is going to be used, right? That's the general concept. So this is known as the generalized select transform, presented, originally developed and used at IBM, I believe, presented in a paper here in 1990. The key idea is to cofactor with respect to a late arriving signal. Okay. So suppose this is your critical path. A is your late arriving input, which is causing this path to be critical. Right. So the path in red is your critical path. The key idea is to say that I'm going to compute the two cofactors of this path, the gates, the logic in this path, with respect to A and A prime. So when A equals 1, this is one case. When A equals 0, this is the other case. And then use A to just select the outputs of one of these two copies. So what you've done is, rather than A, the late arriving signal, having to propagate through many more levels of logic, now you directly used A to feed to the multiplexer. It just has to propagate through one multiplexer delay to the output. Okay. So in the scenario where A is your critical signal, A is late arriving, and that is causing this path to be critical, you've just gained several levels of gate delays on A, okay, potentially improving your circuit timing. Yes, Prateek?
But you still need to figure out where to place the multiplexer. It can be placed closer to B, right? Depending upon how late the A signal is.
Absolutely. Yes, yes. So how many levels of logic you would like to skip depends, well, that impacts two things, right? That impacts the amount of gain you have in timing on A, but it also impacts the amount of logic you need to duplicate. If you take lots of levels of logic, then, but in a way that's good. To gain more timing, you need to pay more cost. So at least the cost, you know, function, the trend is correct. Right? But that's a very good point. So in order to actually do this, you need to use timing analysis to figure out how much I need on A. Because once beyond a certain amount, A may no longer be critical. Maybe one of these other inputs is critical, or maybe some other path entirely elsewhere in the circuit becomes critical. So, you know, you need to figure out the right number of levels of logic. So if you compare the two techniques, we've seen the last two techniques, generalized bypass transform and generalized select transform, they're sort of related, right? In the generalized bypass transform, what you do is you take one of the path inputs and directly feed it as the path output under this condition and use this dou g by dou a. In the other case, well, if you expand, one way of implementing the Boolean difference, as we know, is nothing but the XOR of the cofactors. So if you think of the Boolean difference and implement it literally that way as the XOR of the cofactors, then you will have one copy of this path for computing the cofactor with respect to A prime, another copy for computing cofactor with respect to A, and then you take the XOR of the two, and that goes into the multiplexer. So if you compare this to the generalized select transform, where you have the two copies of the cofactors, and you're just using A as a select signal here, initially, at first glance, which of these appears to be more efficient? They appear to be sort of related, right? Both of them are using multiplexer somehow, and they're different in the sense that, well, they are related in the sense that if A is a late arriving signal, now A has been fed close to the output of the circuit, right? But they are different in the sense that, at least at first glance, this appears to be more area inefficient, right? Because if you're doing this replication anyway, you just do it and you're done. It's almost like this is three-way replication. The original path remains, and then for the dou g by dou a, you have two more copies of this path. Whereas here, you only have two copies of the path, and then you're done, right? That is partially true, right? Not quite entirely true, because in practice, you know, although the select transform appears to be more area efficient, in practice, the Boolean difference is not necessarily computed by replicating the logic. You know, you can simplify that function, the Boolean difference function, and implement it more optimally. Often in practice, the Boolean, you know, when the Boolean difference function, its implementation is very simple, then you will not really be replicating these two copies, right? If you take this function and actually simplify it, you may get a much simpler function. Both transforms have a similar impact on delay. You take a late arriving signal and feed it close to the output. But one key difference is that in the generalized select transform, you can actually reuse parts of the duplicated logic for multiple fanouts, right? Of course, at the cost of adding one mux per fanout. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is, if you have a path that you duplicated here to compute the two cases, A equals 0 and A equals 1, if you tap off from any intermediate point in this path, this essentially is nothing but E cofactored with A prime, right? Oh, I'm sorry, F cofactored with A prime. And this is F cofactored with A. So you can, if F is actually a late arriving signal for some other path in the circuit, you can take this F cofactored A prime and F cofactored A, and for some other path, you can do the same thing. So you can reuse, if F is used somewhere else in the circuit, you can do the same thing by adding another multiplexer there for F, right? So at the cost of one additional multiplexer, you can actually use the different pairs of points here to speed up potentially other paths in the circuit where these points fan out to. So with that, I'm going to conclude the discussion on GBX and GST. So, in generalized bypass transform, you take one of the inputs of the path and directly bypass several levels of logic and directly use that as the output, but you need to evaluate the Boolean difference. In the case of generalized select transform, you have two copies of the path, one for that input, late arriving input equals 0, other for late arriving input equals 1, and based on the value of the input, you select the output of the appropriate copy. So, that brings us to the end of timing optimization. To summarize, there's a variety of methods that are actually used for delay optimization. Right? We talked about circuit restructuring here in this lecture, but as I mentioned, you also do timing optimization during technology mapping. You have circuit sizing, which is a more constrained version of the problem, of the technology mapping problem. And then you have buffer tree optimization, right, which is basically optimizing the interconnects that go between those trees. Among the circuit restructuring techniques that we talked about, namely height reduction, generalized bypass, and generalized select transform, no single technique dominates the others. In other words, actual synthesis tools use combinations of all these techniques because there is different, for different circuits and different locations in the same circuit sometimes, different techniques are applicable. Okay. So no single technique completely dominates the other. And what is interesting is if you take these automatic techniques and go back and apply them to adders, you know, which is what they were inspired from, if you start off the ripple carry adder and apply the height reduction, you actually will get a carry look ahead adder. So that's an interesting way to test whether these techniques actually, after they were automated, still preserve the original intent, which is go back and apply them on the example circuit on using which they were motivated, and you will get the carry look ahead adder, carry bypass adder, and carry select adder by applying these three techniques. Okay. So with that, I'd like to close the discussion on timing optimization. Any questions? Okay. Here's some suggested reading. In the Dimickley book, basically chapter 8.6 covers these techniques, and I'll also be posting some of these papers on Blackboard for you to refer to. Okay. All right. So, I'd like to also get started with a new module. So the next few lectures are going to be on sequential logic optimization. Right? Thus far, we've been talking about techniques to optimize combinational circuits, whether it's two-level synthesis, multi-level synthesis, or timing optimization. All of them were geared towards combinational circuits. Right? But in reality, we know that virtually all circuits that we encounter today in the real world are sequential. Right? They have some amount of state in them. And this is a typical structure for a generic sequential circuit. You have your combinational logic, and you have the flip-flops or latches, which are the clocked elements, and then you have inputs feeding the combinational logic, outputs potentially generated by the combinational logic, and state stored in these flip-flops. The techniques that we have learned so far optimize the combinational logic, and of course, they are useful for sequential circuits, right? But the real question is, the scope of optimization of all the techniques we have learned so far is only limited to a single cycle, meaning that we analyze the combinational logic by cutting all of these state elements out of the circuit and looking at this circuit in isolation. Given the additional information that the state elements are present, and in fact, many of the state elements are indeed generated by the outputs of the combinational logic, given that additional information, what can you do to optimize? How can you further improve, enhance the scope of optimization over and above what you do in combinational logic synthesis? That is the concern in sequential logic optimization. Before we optimize sequential circuits, we first have to see how you specify them, right? Like in combinational circuits, we said we'll start off for two-level minimization either with a truth table or some sort of initial cover, initial sum of products, or you could do the same thing with product of sums. So you have some initial specification for the Boolean functions. In the case of multi-level circuits, we said our initial starting point is going to be a Boolean network. So, these are functional specifications of combinational circuits. How do we specify sequential circuits? As many of you probably know, the de facto standard to specify sequential circuits is in the form of finite state machines or FSMs. We'll be discussing various flavors of FSMs. I'd also want to mention that FSMs are related to an abstraction of computing platforms known as finite automata. Right? Finite automata are similar to FSMs, except they are defined in terms of the input languages that they accept. Right? So when you talk about an FSM, you explicitly talk about the different states in the FSM and what happens in each state. When you define finite automata, you usually don't worry about the states. The states are implicit. What you say is that this is a class of, this is the input alphabet, and these are the sequences of inputs. This is the language in terms of the sequences of input alphabets that this automaton should accept. It turns out that finite automata, that is automata that can be realized with finite number of states, are essentially nothing but finite state machines. Okay. In finite automata, there is also non-determinism sometimes that is used and useful to think of finite automata where state transitions are non-deterministic. We won't be talking about that, of course. We'll be only looking at fully deterministic finite state machines. Okay. A finite state machine is formally, you can think of it as a phi tuple consisting of phi different pieces of information. I is a set of input labels. So these are the inputs that can be presented to the finite state machine. They may be in zeros and ones, in other words, encoded in binary, or they may be symbolic. You know, they may be just symbolic values that consists of your input labels or input alphabet. Similarly, O is the set of outputs produced by the finite state machine, either encoded or symbolic. S is the set of states in the finite state machine. Delta and lambda are actually define the combinational logic part, eventually. Delta is nothing but the transition relation, which tells you what is going to be the next state for a given present state and given input applied to the finite state machine. It's nothing but a mapping from I cross S, the inputs and present state, into the next state. Lambda is the output relation. So this determines the output of the finite state machine, given the input, the current input, and the present state it is in. And this is nothing but a mapping from I cross S to O, which is a set of output labels. Now, in the case of a Mealy machine, you actually have a mapping. The output depends on both the state and the present input. In the case of a Moore machine, the output depends only on the state. So in other words, the lambda, rather than being a mapping from I cross S to O, is only a mapping from S to O. So that is the difference between Mealy and Moore machines. Okay. And of course, what we are talking about applies to both. So here is a structural depiction of the same thing. This is the combinational logic that generates both the next state function, which is your delta, the transition relation is realized as this combinational logic which generates the next state values. And the lambda, the output relation, is realized as this combinational logic which generates the output values. Right? Of course, the inputs are the same. And D is your set of delay elements. I intentionally didn't call them flip-flops or latches because this representation applies to both clocked or synchronous circuits as well as asynchronous circuits. In asynchronous circuits, you won't have latches or flip-flops. You only have delay elements. Okay. Whereas in synchronous sequential circuits, you will have flip-flops or latches in there. Okay. As the delay elements. Okay. In addition to these five things, so to specify a finite state machine, you need to at least have a specification of these five different things. You need to know what the input labels are. You need to know the output labels. You need to know the states. You need to know the next state function or transition relation, and you need to know the output function. Okay. In addition, optionally, you can also specify an initial state, which is a state where the finite state machine comes up when you power it up. How do you represent finite state machines? Two common representations. State transition graph. This is a directed graph where the vertices are the states and the edges are the state transitions. So the states themselves may be annotated with some labels, the state names. The edges typically have the inputs and the outputs associated with that edge, which means that, you know, so a 0/0, for example, here says that when you are in state C and you apply an input of 0, which is the first element of that pair, you generate an output of 0 and then go to state E, right? So that is the usual notation. A fully equivalent notation or representation is a state transition table, where you just enumerate for all present states under every possible input what is going to be the next state and what the output is going to be. So these are completely equivalent representations of the same finite state machine. Okay. So one of them is a graph-based representation, the other is a tabular representation. They're telling you the same thing. You also have completely and incompletely specified finite state machines. Sometimes when you're specifying a finite state machine, you don't care about what happens under certain input combinations or certain states. You just leave them as don't cares. Right. So these are the equivalent to don't cares in truth tables or Karnaugh maps. So in completely specified FSMs, your transition relation delta must specify exhaustively for all possible inputs and all possible present states what the next state is going to be. And similarly, the output relation lambda must specify for all possible inputs and present states what the output is going to be. If either of these is not specified in any case, then it becomes an incompletely specified FSM. Right? Under some conditions, either the next state or output values are don't cares. Give you a couple of examples. So this is an example of incompletely specified FSM. If you see that two dashes here represent don't cares for the outputs. So on these transitions, when the state FSM is in state A and you apply input 1, you know that the FSM should transition to state E. That is specified, but the output value is unspecified. You don't care about it. Similarly, from the transition from B to C under input 0, the output is a don't care. Okay. So here is one example of a don't care in the output. You may also have don't cares in the next state. For example, this is a different example shown as a state table. So from S0, when input 0 is applied, you're saying that you don't care what the next state is going to be. You only care about the next state when input is 1. And similarly, you also have don't cares in the output part of the table. Okay. So that is what we mean by incompletely specified FSMs. And in practice, what you do is you start off with some sort of a English description or specification of what your system is going to do. This is, the classical traffic light controller that is used in most undergraduate digital design courses. So initially, you start off with the problem specification, which is something like this. And as a designer, you manually create the finite state machine by having labels for the inputs, labels for the outputs, and labels for your states, and essentially define the FSM. In this case, the finite state machine is fully symbolic, right? You have these different symbolic variables, which in this case are outputs of the sensors on the different roads that tell you whether there are vehicles or not, the outputs of timers that you use in order to switch the lights, and a reset signal. So you use all of those as symbolic inputs. They may be encoded as 0 or 1. You don't care about that. You're just specifying the finite state machine symbolically. Similarly, the outputs are also symbolic. Okay, and the states, of course, are also symbolic. Okay, so often you are given an input specification that looks like this, and you need to generate eventually a structural output, which is a bunch of gates and flip-flops. So what are the three steps involved in this process? There are some key steps involved in the process of finite state machine synthesis, starting from an FSM specification, where parts of it may be symbolic, to generating eventually actual implementation. The first step is known as state minimization. This is performed because in the initial specification itself, you may have redundancies. You may have multiple states that are essentially functionally equivalent. You don't need two different states, but because of convenience or because of, designer overlooking it, they have just specified the FSM in that way. So you would like to minimize the number of states, and that's exactly what state minimization does. It purely is a transformation on the FSM itself, reducing the FSM to a more compact version. And then you need to, in order to be able to generate the next state and output functions in terms of gates, you need to take those symbolic values, whether they're the inputs, outputs, or the states themselves, and encode them into zeros and ones, so that eventually you can make those next state and output functions as Boolean functions. So that process is known as state encoding, and state encoding has a very fundamental impact on the complexity, the number of gates in your implementation, the longest path through the implementation, and so on, right? So it has a very direct impact on the complexity of the implementation, which is why it's an important problem. Once you do state minimization and state encoding, the rest of it is the same as before, because you can specify the next state and output functions as combinational logic functions, and then you do combinational synthesis. So, in other words, what I'm saying is FSM synthesis boils down to performing state minimization and then performing state encoding in an optimal way, followed by combinational logic synthesis. That's much easier said than done, because often what is optimal is only defined after the combinational logic synthesis is completed. So in a sense, you need to do these steps in a predictive manner, saying that if I did this during state minimization or state encoding, how will eventually my combinational logic circuit be better? That's not always possible to do, but we'll see how we try to do that, to perform state minimization and state encoding for FSM synthesis, and we'll do that in the next lecture.